There was a movie that came out, I think it was in about 2010. I'm getting more recent with my movies. I got in trouble last week for saying that The Matrix was a new movie, because I think it came out in about the 70s or 80s or something, I'm not sure. But we're getting there. The King's Speech, it came out in about 2010. It's about a man whose name is King George the Sixth, who came to the throne when his brother, King Edward the Eighth, abdicated. I think King Edward the Eighth wanted to marry his mistress, and he had to stand down from the throne because of that. And this man, King George the Sixth, had to very quickly step up to become the king. That happened in 1936. The problem is that this King George the Sixth, the one in the picture here, or at least this is the actor who played the part, he had a speech impediment. He stuttered. So people initially, the people in England initially struggled with the idea of having a monarch who was different. I mean, how could you have someone who rules England and the entire British Empire who can't essentially make a public speech? And that's how bad it was at the start. The difference between what people expected in a king and what they got was just too much for some people. Yet I'm told, and someone who knows the history better than I do might be able to correct me, I'm told that he became one of the best kings that England ever had. In some ways, we've got a similar situation happening in the Gospel of Matthew. Jesus has come as Israel's true Messiah. But for most people, the difference between what they expected and what they got was just too great. And the majority of people actually rejected him. And you know, even his most loyal followers at times struggled with their expectations. John the Baptist said at one point, he sent his messengers, remember? They said to Jesus, "Are you the one, or should we expect someone else?" Thanks for the vote of confidence, you know, John the Baptist, he's the herald. Are you the one, or should we expect someone else? Remember when Jesus first said to his disciples he was going to be crucified, what did Peter say? He said, "Surely not, Lord. This will never happen to you." And I guess, in a way, just like George the Sixth, the guy in the picture, Jesus actually ended up being far better, not worse, than what they expected. And Jesus dealt with enemies far stronger than just physical enemies. We know that, don't we? But it was a hard journey for the disciples and for the people to come to grips with what Jesus was about. And what's amazing to me is right up into the fourth last verse of Matthew's gospel, I don't know if you picked it up as it was being read this morning, we have people doubting. I mean, what a way to finish the gospel. They're worshipping, but they, or at least some there, are also doubting. And you think, really? How does that work? Worshipping, doubting. So let's pray, and then we'll look at the passage. Lord, we have expectations of what we think the Christian life is all about. How much of that for us is just cultural baggage, like the Israelites had? And how much is it a true biblical expectation? Maybe we have to have our outlook changed too. And we pray that you speak to us through your word this morning. Amen. We're just going to look at a couple of verses this morning, and I mean literally a couple of verses. It's interesting being a preacher. Sometimes we've covered whole chapters. I think this will be one of the shortest in terms of the verses that we cover. And actually, these verses we'll look at over the coming weeks as we go into the mission month of May. I'm just going to look at verses 16 and 17 this morning, which I'll also put up on the PowerPoint. If you're looking at it in the church Bibles, it's on page 706. It just says this, then, or it could equally be translated, but, the 11 disciples went to Galilee, to the mountain where Jesus had told them to go. When they saw him, they worshipped him, but some doubted. So the NIV starts off with the word then, but the small Greek word d could just as easily be translated but. So we could just as easily say but the 11 disciples. And perhaps that makes more sense, because I think what Matthew is doing is he's comparing the disciples with some of the story that's gone before. So if you'll remember that on Easter Sunday, we read the early part of chapter 28, and we read it again today, and it's the account of the resurrection of Jesus, isn't it? And you might remember that in Matthew's account of the resurrection account, it's flanked on each side with official attempts to discredit the resurrection. So the official position of the Jewish leaders is that they rejected the resurrection. They rejected, in fact, Jesus as Messiah. So they go off spreading rumours that are not true in the few verses just before this one. But in contrast to them, the disciples do what Jesus had told them to do, and they went to the mountain in Galilee where Jesus had told them to go. So, in Matthew chapter 26, verse 32, Jesus said, but after I've risen, I will go ahead of you into Galilee. Okay? And even in our chapter today, Matthew chapter 28, verse 7, the women folk are told to go quickly and tell his disciples, he has risen from the dead and is going ahead of you into Galilee. There you will see him. Now I've told you. So you've got to give the disciples some credit here that in a sense they're obeying what Jesus has told them to do. And I think there's a certain amount of faith demonstrated in doing that. Then the next verse says, but when they saw him, they worshipped him, but some doubted. I mean, how does that happen? How do you put some words together? Like worship and doubt, kind of, they jar a little bit for me. So we're going to look a bit at what these words actually mean. But before we do that, Matthew doesn't seem to have a problem in putting words which almost seem opposites to us together. And we don't have time to look at it this morning, but Matthew has already put these two words together, doubt and worship, earlier in his gospel. It's the story of Peter walking on the water. And you can read it when you get home, if you like, in Matthew chapter 14. Doubt and worship are expressed side by side in that story. And even in our reading today, Matthew chapter 28, verses 8 to 9, we can quickly look at that one. It says, the women hurried away from the tomb, afraid, yet filled with joy, and ran to his disciples, and suddenly Jesus met them. Greetings, he said. They came to him, clasped his feet, and worshipped him. So the women folk have this strange mixture of worshipping on the one hand, but it's also combined with fear. And I don't think that just means a fear of God. I think it means they were scared. But also joy. Matthew has no problem. He'll put them all in the same sentence. And I think that's actually true to human nature, isn't it? We can experience these different things almost at the same time, or at least in very close proximity. But what do these words mean? I've put up a couple of pictures here. You've probably been wondering what they're doing there. To worship in Greek means literally to kiss toward. So Ben Oha came in and saw me during the week, and as he was leaving, he went to kiss my hand. It's kind of a European thing to do. And I said, Ben, you're worshipping me. So it can be just a physical gesture. So a few times in Matthew, and Matthew uses this word worship often, at least in the Greek he does. A few times in Matthew, people came down and bowed down to Jesus. So in Matthew chapter 8 verse 2, the NIV at least says, a leper came to Jesus and it says knelt before him. Same word. Matthew chapter 15 verse 25, again in the NIV, a Canaanite woman came and knelt before Jesus. So it can be just a physical posture. But of course it's meant to indicate something from the heart. So you might remember at the beginning of Matthew's gospel, the Magi come. And what do? They worship a baby, essentially. And I don't think that means that they were just being polite. Do you? And Jesus says something very important when he's tempted in the wilderness in Matthew chapter 4. Remember, the devil says, bow down and worship me. And Jesus says, it's said in Deuteronomy, in the Old Testament, worship God and serve him alone. Whoa. So what these people are doing then at the end of Matthew's gospel, both the women folk in chapter 28 verse 9, where they worship Jesus, and the disciples here in verse 17, they're really saying Jesus is God. So these people are finally recognizing Jesus for who he is. He is God. He is God in the flesh. He is incarnate. He's the true Messiah. He's the rightful King of Israel. Not just of Israel, in fact, of the universe. So the next words for me are really jarring. But some doubted. Now it's not clear, actually, in the verse who it is that doubted. And I'm not going to go into that. But it's clear that there was some there, at least, who doubted. We take it to mean the disciples, because they're the only ones that are mentioned and that are there, as far as we know. Yet you think, what the heck? You know, there was 11 of them. Well, does that mean that there was 6 of them that worshipped and 5 of them that didn't? I mean, how did that work? 6 of them worshipped, 5 of them doubted? Or was it something of a mix of worship and doubt in them all? Because to doubt in the Greek literally means to have two standpoints. I remember hearing a story that if you put 3 accountants in a room, and have we got any accountants here? I hope not. Oh dear. Just block your ears, Norm. If you put 3 accountants in the room, you get 4 opinions. So in modern English, we'd probably say, I'm in 2 minds about this. And again, you think, this is 4 verses from the end of Matthew's gospel. Jesus is about to send them out on the Great Commission. Can this really be happening? I mean, they've just seen Jesus raised. So what's going on here? I think to explain it, we need to try and get inside the headspace of the disciples to understand their world view. I think we need to revisit this topic of what is a Messiah? What does a Messiah do? Well, way back in the book of Samuel, in 1 Samuel chapter 8 verse 20, I've written it up on the screen, Israel said they wanted a king. They're tired of the period of the judges where they get smashed all the time. We want a king. And they said there's 2 reasons they want a king. First is, they said, we want a king over us. Then we will be like all the other nations. And Jesus went, bzzz. Bad reason, guys. Bad reason. Then they said their second reason was, to lead us and to go out before us and to fight our battles. And God said, correct answer. And he gave them a king. Because what they're doing is they're recognizing that they needed divine help to win against their enemies. They were sick of just getting smashed time after time, as I said, by foreign powers during the time of the judges. So God sent along kings, remember? The best of them was probably King David. And probably the classic encounter which illustrates to me what a Messiah is about is the old children's story. We think of it as a children's story of David and Goliath. If David wins against Goliath, the whole nation benefits. Remember, it was a standoff. If David wins against Goliath, the whole nation reaps the rewards, don't they? They said, the Philistines said, we'll be your servants. But if David loses against Goliath, the whole nation suffers. They'll be their servants. There's a lot hanging on this one encounter. So that's what a Messiah does. He wins a battle on behalf of a nation, and it's a battle that they can't win by themselves. So fast forward the tape, hundreds of years, to the beginning of Matthew's Gospel. You don't have to turn to it, but this is one of the verses in the introduction to Matthew's Gospel, and it fills in the history for us very briefly. It says there were 14 generations in all from Abraham, that's the start of the nation with Abraham, to David, their liberator or Messiah. So there's 14 generations in that initial phase, and it's kind of all going uphill. It's going in the right direction. But then there were another 14 generations when it all went bad again, and they all went into exile. That's the low point. Now it's been another 14 generations while I've been waiting for the Messiah to come. So any self-respecting Jew reading this introduction to Matthew, what is he or she expecting? Well, he or she is expecting Jesus to come and do some smashing of Romans. That's what you'd expect. To set Israel free from Rome. I mean, put yourselves in their shoes. If Australia was being threatened by a hostile foreign power, we would look to our allies to come and help us. That's what we did in those days. That's really what we remember in Gallipoli. Jesus, in some ways, doesn't seem to have done anything. He said things like, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you. I mean, it just struck me the other day, who are these enemies? Are these just general enemies? Rome. He won't even make a stand on taxes. Someone says to him, is it right for us to pay taxes to Rome? That was a big issue back then. Rome was taxing the life out of its civilians to keep its army going. Jesus, is it right to pay taxes to Rome? I mean, it's a hot topic. Jesus just says, pay to Caesar's what's Caesar's and to God's what's God's. He just sidesteps the whole issue. And really, I think right up until Jesus was arrested, the disciples are thinking, you know, any minute now, I know he's been talking about this death on a cross thing, but any minute now, he's going to kick into action and do his thing. And they are shattered at this point in the story. That's their headspace. Remember, there's a story in Luke where there's a man called Clopas walking to Emmaus. This is to give you an insight into what's happening in their minds. Jesus draws up alongside this man, I think has a bit of fun with him. He says, what were you talking about? And they said, oh, we were talking about Jesus. We thought he was, past tense, the Messiah. These guys are washed up. That's where they are in their headspace at this time. So one of the keys to understanding, I think, the Gospel of Matthew is just to appreciate how different the Messiah was to what they had expected. But also how different the kingdom is that Jesus has brought in to what they expected. So what is this kingdom then? I think we all agree it's not a physical kingdom. Jesus said, my kingdom is not of this world at one stage. Our problem, I think, is we reduce the kingdom of heaven down to simply about being about. We say, yeah, it's not a physical kingdom. What we reduce it down to is we say, well, it's about forgiveness of sins and a place in heaven when I die. And those things are true. And they're gloriously true. Can I encourage you to read one of those books that Brendan talked about? about the big picture of the Bible. And what all of those authors say is one of the key themes, in fact, what those authors would say is the main theme in the entire Bible is this idea of kingdom of God. What scares me is I think as Christians, we're not much clearer on what it means than what the Jews did. Because the Jews, I think, clearly got it wrong. You know, this kingdom is obviously different to what the Jews expected. Yet, I think it's bigger and more important than the average Christian understands. We tend to say, well, it's not about a physical kingdom, then we can go to the beach and get on with our lives. But can I just say this before we move on? You know, we celebrated Anzac Day yesterday. Anzac Day is really saying kingdoms are important. So much so, in fact, that they're worth fighting for. It really does matter who rules over us. If Nazi Germany wants to come in and rule Australia, that really does matter. And it matters so much that I'm prepared to make sacrifices. So coming back to the King's speech, oh, I won't put the picture up, but King George VI, he came to power, I said, in which year? Do you remember? 1936. You people are listening, that's good. No sooner had he really come to power, and what's going to happen? World War II is looming. So this guy is worried about being able to make a speech. Well, he's got bigger problems, let me tell you. The reason that we need a king is that this sort of thing happens. There are kingdoms in conflict, and only one kingdom will win. Do you realize that? This wasn't war games that was being played back at that time. One kingdom was going to keep going until it won. And that was going to determine the whole way that we lived our life from that point. So the problem we have, I think, as modern Christians is that we reduce the kingdom of heaven to simply being about forgiveness of my sins and a place in heaven when I die. And we essentially, we sideline the church. I wish I had a dollar for every person that said, I'm a Christian, but I'm not interested in church. The Anzacs didn't say, well, you know, there is a battle on overseas somewhere, but it's not going to affect me or my family. Of course it will. It's not enough for us as Australians at that time to say, well, we're part of the Commonwealth, but we're not going to worry about that battle. Of course it's going to affect us. And you know, really the ending of Matthew's Gospel, what we call the Great Commission, only makes sense if there is a kingdom and it's a kingdom worth fighting for. Because essentially what Jesus is doing is he's giving those disciples their marching orders. And we're going to look at that more in coming weeks. And you know, most of them are going to lose their lives in that mission. In fact, it's thought that probably only John was the only one who didn't lose his life as a result of what Jesus is about to do. And there's a lot of very challenging words used in Matthew's Gospel about discipleship. Jesus says things like, if you love father or mother more than me, you're not worthy to be my disciple. If you're not willing to take up your cross and follow me, you're not worthy to be my disciple. You will be brought before rulers and judges for my sake. I am sending you out like sheep amongst wolves. And the list goes on. But I want to finish with some words of comfort and reassurance. I think one of my faults as a preacher, and I know I have many, one of them is I always see the challenges. And I'm a glass half empty sort of a guy. And I think sometimes we need to also preach comfort and reassurance. I was at a prayer meeting this week for pastors earlier in the week at Mount Pleasant. And one of the pastors was bemoaning the fact that I think a parishioner of his had gone on this big tour all around Australia. And each Sunday had visited churches all over Australia of all different denominations. And had been lamenting the fact that, you know what, actually there was very little preached about Jesus. Most of what was said, this person said, was what they called behavior modification. And I said, you know, in Matthew's gospel, the standard in the New Testament is actually higher than in the Old Testament. Jesus says in the Sermon on the Mount, you've heard it said, don't murder, but I say, don't even hate. Says in the Sermon on the Mount, don't commit adultery. That was the Old Testament standard. Jesus says, don't even lust. And we said, you know, how does that help us? It's made it worse, not better. And you know, if that's all we preach, we have made it worse and not better. Jesus, in fact, describes the scribes and Pharisees as people who tie heavy burdens around people's necks and do not lift a finger to help them. But Jesus himself says, come to me, all you who labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. This isn't meant to be too hard. If it sounds too hard, I'm not preaching it right. Yes, we need to preach the challenges, but we also need to preach the solution, and the solution is Jesus. When it comes to following Jesus, if all we say is, you know, don't deny Jesus, Jesus says, if you deny me, I will deny you. That's a pretty hard thing to say, isn't it? If we say, you've got to be willing to take up your cross and follow, that's true. If we say, you need to be prepared to speak in front of kings and generals, you need to go out like sheep amongst wolves and not give people a means of doing that, we've made things worse, not better for them. And maybe as you've read through Matthew's gospel, you've said, look, I know it's true, but that's just not me. That's a different sort of Christian than me. That's a more serious sort of Christian. I'm just not made of that sort of stuff. That's why I love the fact that Matthew finishes four verses out from the end with some of the disciples doubting. I love it. Gives me hope. You see, the Great Commission, if it's to be any success at all, it's not going to rely on those disciples being up to it. It's going to be all to do with Jesus being there with them. You see, another reason I think why these disciples doubted is because they've just failed Jesus so badly. In chapters 26 to 27, all those hard things that Jesus has said about being a follower, they've failed at. I think every one of them. Jesus said, watch and pray. Even just do it for an hour, please. Just pray for 1 hour with me, will you? If that's all that you can do. And they went to sleep, not once, but several times. Jesus had said, don't deny me. In fact, if you deny me, I will deny you. What did they do? Jesus said, don't swear by heaven or by earth. Well, Peter not only swears, but he swears he's never known Jesus. That's a double banger. You know, he commits two sins at once. He doesn't just deny Jesus, but he adds an extra sting to it by adding a curse to it. You know, that's pretty good going, isn't it? And the last we see of them, they're hightailing it off into the distance. That's their headspace at the moment. They're thinking, is this guy even going to have us back? And I love the fact that Jesus calls them brothers in that early part of chapter 28. It says to the women folk, go and tell my brothers, not just my disciples, but my brothers, to meet me at Galilee. Isn't that wonderful? What's interesting is that in Matthew chapter 26, verses 31 to 32, where it all starts to go wrong, Jesus says to them, this very night you will fall away on account of me, for it is written, I will strike the shepherd, and the sheep of the flock will be scattered. But after I have risen, I will go ahead of you into Galilee. Jesus, in a sense, knows what these guys are going to do. It doesn't excuse their failure. But Jesus is bigger than my failure. The truth is, it's the shepherd's role to be strong, It's the sheep's role to follow and to be protected. The sheep don't have to win the battle. That's the role of the shepherd. That's the role of a Messiah, if you like. If we can win the battles for ourselves, we don't need a Messiah. And really, the challenges that are being presented with us here are too great for us. Our role is simply to follow and to trust. What's interesting is if you go through those two chapters again where the disciples failed at all those points, they denied Jesus, they swore, all those things, couldn't watch, couldn't pray, at every point they failed, Jesus was faithful. He made the good confession before Pilate. He did watch, he did pray, he didn't deny. All those things that we should do as disciples, Jesus comes through with flying colours. So we started off talking about doubt and fear. Really, the question is not, will I experience doubt and fear? Of course I will, if I'm a normal human being. Really, what Jesus is asking them to do is something that's beyond human capacity. The question isn't, will I doubt and fear? The question is, what will I do with my doubt and fear? Will I allow it to become disbelief and rejection, like the leaders in Israel, or even like Judas? Or will I take it to Jesus, who after all is my Messiah? So Matthew's gospel begins and finishes the same way. It begins with Emmanuel, which means what? God with us. And it finishes with Jesus saying, lo, I am with you always. That's the source of my confidence. It's not my own ability. It's not even my faith. And that's why the Great Commission has any chance of success. If it's based on the disciples' abilities, you know, any minute now they're going to hit a purple patch and it's going to be great. I don't think that's what's being said. What's being said is we have reason for believing it will succeed simply because Jesus says, I'm with you to the end of the age. And in a sense, there's no ascension in the Gospel of Matthew. Did you realize that? Jesus' presence just continues on. So I also started off talking about the king's speech. I want to finish off with what I think was one of his best speeches. It was his speech just after World War II had started in 1939. And his little girl, 13-year-old girl, whose name is Elizabeth, came and gave him a poem which he decided he would read as part of his speech. And we're going to use this as our closing prayer. You probably know it. The poem says, and I said to the man who stood at the gate of the year, give me a light that I may tread safely into the unknown. And he replied, go out into the darkness and put your hand into the hand of God. That shall be to you better than light and safer than a known way. So I went forth and finding the hand of God, trod gladly into the night. And he led me towards the hills and the breaking of day in the lone east. So, heart, be still. What need our little life, our human life, to know if God hath comprehension? In all the dizzying strife of things both high and low, God hideth his intention. God knows his will is best. The stretch of years which wind ahead so dim to our imperfect vision are clear to God. Our fears are premature. In him all time hath full provision. Then rest. Until God moves to lift the veil from our impatient eyes, when as the sweeter features of life's stern face we hail, fair beyond all surmise, God's thought around his creatures our mind shall fill. And he finished that speech, I believe, with these words, may the Almighty hand guide and uphold us all.